the big question is, what is the gene?
The nucleus contains the master molecule of life, DNA.
The most exciting molecule around.
The human genome is a very big place.
It's been described as an explosion in a spaghetti factory.
How would we find genes for human disease? How would we find the genes underlying cancer?
This is Base Pairs, the podcast about the power of genetic information.
The great scientific challenges transcend national frontiers and national prejudices, for the language of science has always been universal.
Hello again, everyone. I'm Andrea Alfano, and I'm of course joined again by my co-host, Brian Stollard.
Hi, everybody. If you listen to our first two episodes, you know that on Base Pairs, we like to look at the ways in which harnessing the power of genetic information has already shaped our world, and how genetic information is becoming an even more powerful tool today.
So far, our stories have been set either in the past or the present. But today, we're really going to straddle both, because we're going to be talking about using DNA evidence to piece together the past.
You're talking about how we can trace DNA samples CSI style.
That's part of it, yeah. Except I'm not just talking about matching DNA to a criminal like you might have seen on Law & Order. I'm talking about forensic investigations that reach deep into humankind's past, matching bits of DNA across thousands of years. But our story does start out with a murder.
The Iceman.
He was found in a glacier, frozen in time for 5,000 years.
An ancient murder mystery.
You can't help but ask the question, what is his story?
Secrets hidden in his genetic code.
We're rewriting the history of humankind.
Whoa, who turned on the drama? What did I just listen to?
I did warn you that we're starting out with a murder. What you just heard is from the trailer for a recent TV special called Iceman Reborn from PBS's Nova series. And this mystery man goes by the name of Utsi these days. He was named after the place where he was found, high up in the Utzal Alps, on the border between Italy and Austria. Some tourists found him sticking out of a glacier as they were hiking up a mountain back in 1991.
I remember this. Utsi was reportedly discovered by a pair of adventurers hiking those frozen peaks.
Yeah, you could just imagine how bewildered they must have been. One moment you're admiring the beauty of a snowy mountain range, and the next you're standing over a frozen corpse.
An accident of global warming, maybe? He was just so well preserved that they at first thought Utsi had died recently. It was only later that experts declared Utsi the oldest intact mummy ever found.
So he's got all of his parts, minus a few fingernails, but he's got all of his internal organs.
That's Lindsay Barone. She's an anthropologist who works over at Cold Spring Harbor Lab's DNA Learning Center.
But more interestingly is it appears that he was murdered. And so, trying to figure out what happened, he clearly didn't die of natural causes. So what drove that? Why was he moving around the Alps with all of his belongings? He had an axe, he had clothing, he had a first aid kit, he had all of this stuff with him. So trying to reconstruct those movements and figure out what's going on, it's just a really intriguing piece of anthropological history, basically.
Lindsay knows so much about Utsi because apart from the South Tyrol Museum in Italy,
which is near where Utsi was found,
the DNA Learning Center is the only place in the world where you can find an official Utsi replica.
Replica really doesn't do it justice. It was created using an enormous 3D printer to make a mold, which was then filled with resin and painstakingly hand-painted. The artist even got to touch the real Utsi to make sure he got certain textures right.
I saw the process on the television up there, and it looked like it took a lot of work and effort, but I think it paid off because it looks really realistic.
This class is one of many that has traveled to the DNA Learning Center to learn about Utsi.
Science today is so advanced that you can just get like DNA out of pretty much anything.
Yeah.
Scientists have indeed sequenced Utsi's DNA and have been able to learn quite a bit from it.
Also, they can figure out everything, like his eye color
and his blood type.
They can even figure out if he had heart disease or if he was lactose intolerant or not.
But what's really cool is that high school students also get to learn about Utsi themselves. For one activity, they get to sequence some of their own DNA.
That sequence is made up of the chemical base pairs in DNA, known by their initials, A, T, C, and G.
And they compare their sequences to those of their classmates, other people from around the world, and ancient humans including Neanderthals and Utsi.
So what they're looking for are whether or not they have the same base pairs or whether those base pairs differ. And the more base pairs the students have in common with the sequence they're comparing to, the more similar genetically they are.
It makes sense. Over time, the genome accumulates a bunch of random mutations. So if you're only very distantly related to another person or another organism, you'll have more differences in your sequences, even if you're looking at a gene that you share.
So UTSI is very, very similar to the modern European reference sequences we have. A lot of students tend to be very similar to UTSI as well.
When the students compare their sequences to those of Neanderthals, though, they start to see more differences. Neanderthals and humans went their separate evolutionary ways around 500,000 years ago and are considered a different species than the humans that are around today.
What's the difference between the Neanderthal and
the human skull? I feel like their skull was bigger.
Yeah.
Than the human.
And the teeth were...
Their skull is like, yeah, so
bigger skull. This one, he suffered from a...
And their rib cage was a little bit bigger.
Okay.
Larger ribs.
But they're actually pretty similar.
At the DNA Learning Center, models of human and Neanderthal skeletons stand side by side so that you can compare their physical features. And even after 500,000 years apart, the similarities are striking.
Like, he's only five. I mean, it may seem old to us, but for like the whole history of like humans, it's really not that old.
He's right. 500,000 years isn't all that long in evolutionary time. In fact, humans and Neanderthals weren't even truly apart for that entire time. Since they were so similar, they could and sometimes did mate with one another. Most of us even have traces of these encounters in our DNA.
Modern humans that are not of recent African origin tend to have between 1 and 4% of their DNA from Neanderthals. Depending on the ancestry of the student or the ancestry of the individual that is being compared to the Neanderthal, there might be a few more differences or not quite as many.
Our textbooks tell us that modern humans, Homo sapiens, and Neanderthals are different species, but they're still close enough to have offspring together. So then, what makes them different species?
That is a very good question.
So this gets at a kind of a skeleton in the closet in evolutionary thinking.
That's Adam Siepel,
professor at Cold Spring Harbor Laboratory and chair of the Simon Center for Quantitative Biology.
And I asked him that question about modern humans and Neanderthals.
We don't really know what a species is. We could argue about whether they really should be called separate species, and some people indeed argue that they should be considered all sort of members of the same species, maybe subspecies or populations within that species.
Wow, even people who study this stuff for a living are confused about this.
It can be confusing, but all of that seemingly chaotic gene swapping...
Mating, yeah?
All of this mating of modern humans and Neanderthals actually helped Adam and his team discover surprising new parts of the history of humankind.
So we found evidence of an earlier migration out of Africa, resulting in gene flow between modern humans and Neanderthals some 50,000 years before people generally think of modern humans having immigrated out of Africa at all.
So modern humans started in Africa and eventually migrated out and explored other parts of the world. That's the famous out of Africa migration. And now Adam is saying that wasn't the first time modern humans left Africa?
Yep, the famous out of Africa migration was about 50,000 years ago. But Adam and his team found evidence that some adventurous modern humans left way earlier than that, about 100,000 years ago. And they were able to figure it out because early modern humans and a group of Siberian Neanderthals had children together around that time.
Evidence? What kind? Ancient bones?
Yes. Well, Adam's team didn't discover the ancient bones. They just work with genomes, and they were able to get the genome of a Siberian Neanderthal from another group of scientists. Adam's laboratory is essentially a collection of desktop computers in an office connected to some very powerful supercomputers. He does experiments by gathering genome sequences and crunching numbers to compare them and learn about them.
I'm also fascinated by the idea of using powerful statistical and mathematical and computational tools to sort of decode this hidden level of meaning in genome sequences, to be able to get at these secret stories by being clever enough in the way we decode them. It's sort of like a form of detective work, I guess, or forensics for the past.
It's kind of like that activity the kids were doing before at the DNA Learning Center, where they compared their sequences to those of Ötzi and Neanderthals to see where the base pairs differ. Adam's work seems like that, but all grown up.
Right, it's a lot like that. So Adam and his team were working with this Siberian Neanderthal genome and three other ancient genomes. Two are from Neanderthals who lived in Europe, and one from another species of ancient human that was also living in Siberia. And they compared these ancient genomes with sequences gathered from modern humans with different ancestries.
Yeah, so what we do is we build what we call genealogies. They're sort of like family trees that are describing the relationships among these individuals across the genome.
So Adam is building a family tree that goes back tens of thousands of years, but he's only got a few family members within a giant family to work with. That sounds kind of impossible.
It is pretty amazing. It's important to keep in mind, though, that these family trees don't show direct relationships between individuals, all the mothers and fathers and children along the way. The individuals whose genomes Adam analyzed sort of served as representatives for large populations of humans.
So it's a tree that shows when different populations of humans separated from one another.
Right. And they can tell how much time passed between these separation events by looking at the sizes of chunks of the genome that are similar between these individuals.
We can use that as a clock when we try to date these ancient events. First of all, you have fairly large chunks of DNA from your grandparents, right? But smaller chunks of DNA from your great-grandparents, and even smaller chunks of DNA from your great-great-grandparents. And as you go back many, many generations, those chunks get smaller and smaller by this process that occurs every generation of recombination, of breaking up chromosomes and putting them together in new combinations.
When they compared the Siberian Neanderthal's genome with those of modern humans from today, they saw something that really surprised them.
But we saw this strange pattern that we couldn't explain, and that to our knowledge had never been reported previously, indicating gene flow in the opposite direction from modern humans into Neanderthals.
Meaning chunks of modern human DNA in the Neanderthal's genome.
And affecting only this one Neanderthal sample, the one that was found in the Altai Mountains in Siberia.
And the chunks of Neanderthal DNA that we see in the genomes of many modern humans today.
So like what Lindsay was talking about earlier, how students with certain ancestry had more similarities to Neanderthals.
Right, those are a lot bigger on average than the chunks of modern human DNA that Adam and his team found in this Siberian Neanderthal's genome.
Oh, so that means that the encounter that left modern human DNA in the Neanderthal genome happened a lot earlier than the encounter we already knew about. The one that left little bits of Neanderthal DNA in our own genomes today.
Yep, since this unexpected genetic trace of modern humans showed up only in these Neanderthals who lived in Siberia, Adam and his team proposed that a group of early modern humans, who are now otherwise lost to history, left Africa a lot earlier than the previously known out-of-Africa migration 50,000 years ago. And that conclusion held up when Adam's team put it to the mathematical test.
And these methods are quite intensive. Some of our programs will run for 2 weeks or more on a computer cluster involving hundreds of compute nodes.
But if we know that humans and Neanderthals had children together at least a couple of times, does that mean it happened a lot more times that we just don't know about?
That we can't say for sure. But we do know that those human Neanderthal hybrid children went on to live among humans and Neanderthals and seemed to be accepted just fine in both communities.
So what I think is really interesting about our finding is that it suggests both of these events occurred. Human-Neanderthal hybrids were absorbed both by modern human and by Neanderthal populations. I think it's very interesting, and in some ways it's sort of encouraging about us all being one big happy family.
A big happy human family. That is pretty encouraging.
Right, I think so. And the students at the DNA Learning Center pick up on this too when they realize how genetically related we all are.
It's one of those things that I think really helps that clarify their position with respect to all of these people that came before them, with respect to other people that are living now, with respect to the Neanderthals and other species. You know, they get really excited being able to make those connections for themselves.
And that's all for now. Episode 3 is closing out.
We'd like to thank Adam Siepel, as well as Lindsay Barone and everyone else at the DNA Learning Center.
Open to the public, we do scheduled tours.
With special thanks to the Blue Dot Sessions, Mark D'Angelo, Alex Fitch, Chris Zabrinsky, Broke for Free, Little Glass Men, and David Setstay, who provided music or sound in this episode.
And we'd like to thank you, listener, for tuning in.
We'll be back next month with another episode, but in the meantime, you can check out our LabDish blog. There, you'll find bonus photos and videos about the episode you just heard.
You can also join in on the conversation and tell us what you think of the show. We're coming to you from Cold Spring Harbor Laboratory, a private, not-for-profit research and education institution at the forefront of molecular biology and genetics. So if you'd like to support the research that goes on here, you can find out how to do that at cshl.edu.
And feel free to pay us a visit. Between our undergraduate research program, meetings and courses, graduate school, the DNA Learning Center, and public events, there really is something for everyone.
I'm Andrea.
And I'm Brian.
And this is Base Pairs. More science stories soon.